had to pull deep out of my an alt-right hole that I was in.
Smart. I mean, we could start here, but like there is, I think that bubble's about to pop. I think the say anything comedy, it's like just not as interesting.
It's just not funny.
It's not funny.
It's not funny.
It's been overwrought. It kind of reminds me of kids cursing more because their parents are out of town.
That's the whole feel
to that style of comedy.
Substitute teachers, let's fuck her up. I'm going to
use swear words. It's a little bit of that. And like this, obviously it's done well, but it's just, the novelty has worn off. And especially when you have Trump in office saying all that and more.
Yeah.
It's just not as interesting.
Yeah, when he won the election, there was something else that happened. Oh, yeah, it was when he won the majority vote against Kamala. I was like, oh, I don't think I need to be as hard on women as I've been in my stand-up. I was like, I can ease up a little bit. I think we might have that covered.
Right. Globally. I felt the same way where I'd shot my special in February of this year. Last year. And there were some like digs against women that I thought were like, yeah, I could take some shots at women. They deserve a couple blows here and there.
Yeah.
And I typically take shots at men kind of in equal turn. And then I'm editing these clips and putting them out right now where I'm like, it doesn't feel as fun.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel as fun just knocking on women when it's like,
that's Ari Shaffir's whole thing is he's like, record the special and then get it out immediately.
Yes.
Because the more time you add, the more feeling like
rots.
Like last night I was like, did anything crazy happen on... on New Year's, and everybody was like, what? And I was like, anything crazy? And I got off stage, my friend John was like, there was like a horrible, you know, that whole New Orleans thing happened where people died. So a lot of people are like, do you know about that? And I was like, oh, I really didn't know about that. It's like crazy how you could, a whole audience zeitgeist changed just by one thing that happened.
Have you ever had a joke that you liked but didn't work, and then it started working because of current events?
Oh, good question. I don't know if I have. I've had the opposite.
Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah, right.
I had the opposite happen a lot. I used to have a joke about having a penis that people don't like now.
Yeah, right.
I mean, now it's back. But there was a minute there where I could not do it at
that,
all.
That oscillating fan of culture.
Like, wait, do you? And if you don't, fuck you. But do you? I was like, no. The whole joke is I don't. But no, have you had ones like that?
I've had a couple times where it happened and it felt pretty nice. I had a joke about... Trump brought back jobs. If you consider Trump brought back jobs to Americans, if you consider terrorists a job, and how our terrorists all used to be, you know, from overseas, and now we have good white American terrorists. I'm butchering my joke, but I had that joke and it just didn't work. And then January 6th happened.
Oh yeah, and then the CEO guy.
Yeah. And then just another joke I have of, maybe this is just like a general thing I've noticed, is that stuff I do in New York City that tends to work on like a cultural note. And fails everywhere else, I realize that 2 or 3 years later, it'll start working everywhere else.
Let put it to rest and bring it back,
Well, we just kind of live in the future here.
Yeah.
Like, culturally, we just see trends kind of happening before they happen.
Oh, my God. That's what I hate when you're at the Cellar and Australians come, and you're like, listen, retard is fine now.
Yes, exactly.
It's fine now. And they're like, oh, and I'm like, no, you guys are exactly 3 years behind us.
Uh-huh.
It's so annoying.
And that whole, like... What if cancer culture wasn't real? I'm like, we also know, we notice it, and then we notice it wasn't real, and now we're actually beyond both of those subjects.
Yeah.
Both of them retired.
Right. Yeah, totally. And what was I going to say? When you get on stage and you're like, oh, you guys aren't quite here yet.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny how there are some places where I'll go. Like, I remember when I lived in Buffalo and I went to Toronto, and they were so far ahead, and I was like, oh, wow.
Huh.
Yeah,
Buffalo's very behind.
Buffalo's very behind.
Rochester is pretty with it.
Yeah, Rochester's with it. It's all, I even think LA is slightly with it. I mean, they're sleepy, but they're with it.
Yeah.
They're like kind of apathetic, but they are with it. But the South gets a little weird. The thing I've been working on lately, which I'm like grinding into, is I'm trying to get some admission from women that they were attracted to their father. And it is crazy. I mean, it's like, I'll be
at
the
Cellar. We've been both fighting over this. Like,
dude.
Yeah.
I've grinded 3 shows I did last night, and I'm like, I have to make this work. And, you know, we both are so obsessive compulsive about jokes where mm-hmm. we just are like, there has to be a sociological switch that I can hit in their brains that allows them to see how it's funny. And you'll just keep
I'm
going.
I'm not wrong.
Yeah.
I have a joke with a similar implication of, yeah, you can't, women come faster if I remind you of your dad or something like that.
Yeah, totally.
I did it on stage last night. And the crowd's like, ooh, I'm like, it's a perfect joke.
Yeah.
It, don't you dare pull back on a perfect.
I had no idea. Like, I've asked my audiences, my fans. I've been like, were any of you guys like kind of subconsciously attracted to your fathers? And they're like, it's silence. And I'm like, really? Not one of you has come to terms with this? And now I'm doing it at the Cellar, this whole thing about like covert incest, which is like where your parent is having sex around you and it's this really gnarly shit. And it is like, by the last show, I got them on board, but it was in the lounge, which already feels like you're in that opium den.
Yes.
But my goal is like by the end of the tonight, the VU must accept. Must accept that they're attracted to their father slightly.
Wow. How did the Muslim joke you're working on end up?
Had to kill it from the Palestine thing.
Oh, yeah.
The Muslim joke about, No, totally dead in the water with Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
About how I don't, how you can regurgitate the Quran to me and I still don't believe that you actually believe that the angel Gabriel is. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I really like that one, but...
You solved the Friday crossword. How do you believe this?
Right.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
It was your wording. It sounds like I'm saying, yeah.
Yeah. And so now with the whole Palestine thing, people kind of shut down. I'm sure it can come back.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to do jokes now about how people have to feel the need so much that they have to choose a side about Israel-Palestine. Like everybody, all of a sudden, because of the internet, people are like, I have to align with a tribe of human beings... Which, that's like my whole hour right now, is that you have to align with somebody. Like, you have to be trans, you have to be lesbian, you have to be... There's no murky in between, which is interesting because we think that we're in an age of, like, super fluidity. But our generation doesn't have much of that. The Gen Zs are kind of floating around.
Yeah. And I think we've judged that generation wrong a little bit.
Yeah.
I think I tutor some college kids, and they're mostly apathetic.
Really?
The smart ones, too. They're like, oh, what's going on? Is there, like, a war going on?
I think they're
just... As all of us were, like, more interested in sucking and fucking.
Mm-hmm.
And it's harder to do that now because they don't, like, drink and socialize as much. So they're, like, all little.
Are your kids on their phones all the time?
No, I just do it via Zoom. So, no. And also, I work with, like, a nonprofit. So it's just, like, very smart kids I get to work with. So they're
That's sick.
On it. So.
What was the picture that you posted on Instagram of you, like, in front of a math?
There is a teacher in New Jersey who does my puzzles with her class, and she teaches calculus, and she messaged me about it. And I was like, I teach math, just incidentally. I'm a big fan of, like, good math education. She was like, you want to come in and just do a guest lecture? So I do that, like, once a year.
Wait, what is it? What math puzzles?
Monday Punday, the pun puzzles. She does the pun puzzles with the class as, like, a warm-up, which is kind of how I started because my teacher, Ann Schwartz, did it for me.
Wait, I don't know the... Pun puzzles.
You don't know Monday Punday?
No. I mean, I know that's your thing. You're...
Oh, man. Wow.
Tell me. Yes.
It's a website called MondayPunday.com. It's also an app. I did for about 10 years every Monday. I would draw a picture that is a wordplay puzzle of, and if I may, they're pretty good.
Really?
I spent 10 years on it. I got pretty good at, like, designing pretty tricky, pretty satisfying puzzles. But like a caveman sculpting a vase would be the drawing, and the answer would be Harry Potter. So it's just 500 of those.
And how do they solve it?
Now you type it in the answer and it validates it.
Oh, so you draw the picture.
So you see the picture. So what I you look at the picture and you guess the answer. And the answer should be a familiar phrase.
But how is it related to math?
It's not. It's a good mental warm-up. So she shows one to the class. Some of them happen to be about math just because it's one of my interests. But
oh, that's very fun.
Mm-hmm.
And you use that always in your stand-up too. Where you're pulling things to make your drawing... things together that shouldn't necessarily be together.
Yeah. And so that's about how it goes for me. Yeah, that's well put. Yeah.
My favorite part of your set is when you've been doing all this stuff that's very like, there's like turn of phrase, there's very like men and women, there's dating, and then all of a sudden you slap everybody with your bipolar mom.
Yeah.
Did you do that in your special?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah, good. I should have closed on that, but I put it kind of more because I'm like, let's work on keeping people for the first 20 minutes and then hopefully for the next 20 minutes. And if they turn it off for the last 15, so what? I don't want to like, I didn't want to save my best stuff for the end in case they didn't watch it. So I closed with like a good chunk, but not my best chunk.
That's actually the thing I've heard that you should do.
Yeah. Bert was talking about how you want to hit a crescendo at 20 minutes because that's the moment they might turn it off. So like give them no reason to leave at the 20 minute mark.
Interesting.
So I put what there were probably three closers in that set, three things that could have been closers, and they put the best two first, and then the probably the weakest closer of them last.
Oh my God, that's so difficult. I haven't considered doing that.
I just...
Because my hour on the road builds up to this big, the period thing.
Mm.
And so I wonder...
I don't know if I know the period thing.
About with the different phases of a woman that were shifting people all the time.
Oh, a little... Yes, I think I've caught
yeah.
parts of this, yeah.
Which me and your fiancé have a lot in common.
Mm-hmm.
We bond over that. We should...
PMDD?
Yeah. PMDD is horrifying. I've really battled it, though, with exercise and not eating sugar.
I suffer from PMDD.
Yeah, you suffer from PMDD. Yeah. Hell yeah. But yeah, so you put it in the middle, and then you ended on... Did it feel weird to do that?
No, it's kind of how I was doing. Well, I hadn't run it that way on the road. I had, like, run the first 40 minutes. I couldn't bring myself to run it long form the way I wanted to, and I actually switched what shouldn't have been an opening joke to the beginning, because I was getting so sick of opening on the safe relationship stuff.
Yeah.
That I was like, let's just do something interesting and talk about being, like, Jewish from the South and my parents for the first third. And it was just, maybe it was technically wrong, but my enjoyment of the material was far more important than what is, like, sound structure. It's not a bad thing to open with. It's just not as inviting as, my girlfriend's a swimmer and her shoulders are as big as mine. You know, like, it's fine, good. I'm sure people will like it. But, like, to me, like, Southern anti-Semitism and why it's better in New York and you know, cultural heritage.
Was it
heritage
bad in
Cajun.
The South?
The bit is... How can you know, the South has fewer Jews and more anti-Semitism, and it's like, how can you hate Jews when you've never even met the most annoying ones?
Whereas
New Yorkers have a little more...
Right, they're like, you're a good Jew, not one of these other Jews.
They have a basis for their complaints.
Yeah. So was it fucked up living in the South? I mean,
no.
Ronan was like that too.
People didn't understand Judaism enough to hate it properly. So if people like people just had so many misconceptions and confusion about it. When I lived in Corpus Christi for 10 years, which being white was novelty enough. They didn't need to know that I like being Jewish was just like, okay, I don't really even know what that means. And then it was kind of a novelty. When I moved to Atlanta, I went to like a Christian private school, and it was kind of a novelty enough there that people were kind of just like, oh, Jew, you're the Jew dude. Ah, Jew. Yeah. And it was just kind of neat to them.
You went to Christian private school? I didn't know this.
Mm-hmm.
For how long?
4 years.
For high school?
Mm-hmm.
Whoa.
Hated it socially. Academically, fantastic. Amazing teachers.
What was it socially? All boys?
Oh, no. It was just Southern old money. Like, very aristocratic Southern aristocracy. Yeah.
Do you come from money? You don't come from money.
I do. Upper middle class. My dad made $100,000 to $150,000 a year throughout my childhood and saved very well. And my mom made some money on top of that.
How did your mom make money with raging bipolar?
She's gotten worse over the years, but she...
Is she going to see the special? Is she going to be mad?
She's seen all of it.
She doesn't mind.
She doesn't like The Note. I love The Note. It's the funniest thing, I think,
the
in the special.
Is incredible.
Thank you. Yes.
Watch the special to see The Note. It's a
you
note from
see the
her.
Note. It's the best part. What's that?
It's a note from her. That...
From her to Laura, my fiance.
Yeah.
She was. She had a great career. She was med tech microbiologist at different points. Studied the AIDS virus for Johnson & Johnson. And she was a somewhat normal person. I think pain is kind of physical pain is what's put her into such a bad state. Being a widow, having never really managed her mental health. And
they were together when he died?
Uh huh.
How old were you?
He died when I was in 2016, so I was 28.
From?
Parkinson's, which he had for like 16 years.
What does that do to a person? That's the shaky one?
Uh-huh. Yeah. It slowly shuts down your body and like control over it.
And were they in love?
They fought a lot.
But in a passionate love, or was it just like, we're doing this for the children?
They could have gotten divorced and it would have been reasonable. Like my dad would sometimes be like, Matthew, I just think me and your mom are... gonna get divorced. I'm like, yeah, duh. Why haven't you?
Yeah.
She was mean to him, I think, but obviously I'm maybe being biased towards the one who passed away.
Right.
I love my mom very much, but she can have her nasty moments. And my dad was generally a sweetheart, but a lot of times in relationships with men and women, with parents, it's like the dad's crime is not doing enough, and the mom's crime is doing too much, and it's kind of easier to condemn the missteps than the lack of action.
Well, the person screaming, even if the person is screaming, like, you need to be active in this family, mm-hmm. is the one who gets the brunt of it rather than the one who's, like, laying in a lazy boy and ignoring everybody.
Right. My dad was like, I love you no matter what. My mom was like, you got to get your grades together. You got to work hard. You got to be on top of shit. And it's like,
it's very.
My mom spurred me to be the person I am today by some kind of negative shaming stuff, but it didn't work. And my dad was coddling.
Which you're relentless with. Me and you have come together over our obsession with, I remember I came into the cellar once and I was like covered in KT tape and you were like, what are you doing for exercise? And I was like, I'm running 9 miles every day. And you were like, stop immediately. Stop immediately doing that.
Don't do that.
Yeah. And you're like, you're just ruining you're wrecking your body. Yeah. And I remember being like, okay, I have to chill. But you've had that, right? The obsessive exercise constant. And you have weight shit like I do, right?
I used to. I've kind of made. I'm a fairly tall man, and I was paranoid about getting fat for so many years, and now I'm like, oh, it's probably not going to happen to me with how active I am and how much I naturally eat.
Were you ever fat?
No.
You were just worried about
it. My mom was anorexic, or I don't know. She was 5'7", 105, 110 pounds my whole life, which is crazy.
Also, can I just say I love that you're marrying a very strong, I mean, she's very thin, but she could kick my fucking ass. Usually guys who grew up with waify paper moms end up with paper wives.
It's not attractive to me.
And she could bench me.
I wouldn't even say subconscious, probably in the conscious brain, I wasn't great at sports. I spent my whole childhood wanting to be better at sports.
Yeah.
I want my kids to have an advantage I didn't. And I look at Laura, I'm like, that'll be nice.
Yeah.
Also being big and being tall is great. Yeah. I think for either sex, it gets you farther in the world.
She's ripped. It's crazy.
She's strong.
Yeah.
Her legs are still really strong.
Yeah,
her calves.
Swimming. My mom was a swimmer like her, like almost to the Olympic level. And she's still, she doesn't do anything. And she's just ripped. It's crazy.
It's like having I've kind of started to learn if you really blitz it in your like teens and 20s, you can be lazy for the rest of your life.
I'm the opposite. So I was lazy my whole teens. Like I was just eating constantly, smoking weed, getting high, thinking about killing myself. And now I can eat like a meal a day and not gain weight. I mean, I just followed a nutritionist's advice to the T.
That's great.
And did everything that he did, gained 5 pounds because he had me eating at 1,700 calories, which is 4,000 more than, or 400 more than I'm used to.
And you gain weight eating 1,700 calories a day? That sucks.
It's so annoying. I've gotten blood work done, and they're like, yeah, sorry, you have the slowest metabolism on the face of the planet. And I'm like, give me a pill. And they're like, no. And I'm like, you know what? It's okay, because I did make up for lost time. I mean, I was shoveling as a child. But I think it's the opposite for if you're super athletic as a kid. It actually does pay off later.
It does, unfortunately, or fortunately.
Yeah.
I had – this is the lamest brag ever, but I did a Machu Picchu hike with Laura and her friends and one of her friends, her best friends, Elizabeth Beisel, who's an Olympic silver medalist. Wow. I was like, wow, you eat more than anyone I've ever seen. And I'm like, you're friends with Michael Phelps. She was like, oh, yeah. For like a non-active – I'm lucky. But I used exercise over the years, and it took me a long time to come to terms with it as a like form of self-abuse. I don't think people realize how common it is that sometimes you're doing all these things because it's a way of punishing yourself, of fuck you, you piece of shit, and that's why you can kind of muster something. You can muster more workouts, longer workouts, harder workouts, and not listen to your body. And right now what I'm dealing with, which is a huge frustration, is everything's just falling apart. I can't run. I can't bike. My knee, my back, my shoulder, my knee gave out. And my knee gave out on your birthday. So I think a lot about your birthday. When I'm like, how long have I been injured? When was Jordan's birthday?
Just when we were by the water?
Yeah. I biked up. Remember, I biked up, and it was a really heavy hill getting up to Prospect. Yeah. Nasty hill. Biked back. And then I went for like a really hard swim afterwards with fins on. And I got home, and my legs have been stiff for like a couple of months already because I was biking too much. And I sat down, and my knee just goes, like, just, and it hasn't felt good since. And
you got to do knees over toes, guy.
I'm doing all of it. I'm doing crazy PT.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So it's
some of the rehab stuff. I'm going to the gym and spending an hour just doing like band.
That's
clamshells.
Always that's what happens to athletes. My sister's all mangled now. She's a hockey player. She's all her shoulders all locked up. She's got tennis elbow for no goddamn reason.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Does she have an unhealthy relationship with exercise? Is it compulsive?
She was D1.
Ah.
And then she was Orange Theory instructor.
That shit is so bad for you. I don't know. I hope Orange Theory doesn't sponsor your show, because that was kind of the beginning of my problems.
Really?
I remember.
I've never done it. I've never tried it.
Buddy, like, I remember I would do it when I traveled because I was like, I have to take a class. I can't work out hard enough on my own. I got to do a class.
Yeah.
So I'd find Orange Theory, and I walked in one day in a random Dallas studio, and we go, okay, 2 minutes on the treadmill. Let's get warmed up. Okay, stop the treadmill. Now we're going to go mile for time. When you tell me to do a mile for time, and you take that seriously with 2 minutes warm up, something's going to snap.
Yeah, that's crazy.
A mile for time?
They didn't do endurance. It wasn't just slow and steady, put it at six or whatever.
I mean, 2 minutes of warm up and then that. And then we did the rest of the workout. But like, you don't do that at the beginning of a class.
Yeah.
A mile for time should take 30 minutes of stretches and activation. Yeah. And like
people were sprinting for a mile?
They wanted you to see if you could go a best time. That was the goal of it. And you're going to put your time on the board. We're going to see how everyone ranks.
No way. Yeah. Time on the board?
Yeah.
Toxic.
Toxic. Very toxic.
No, I don't like that.
And it also has your heart rate on the screen is how it works. So you can see who's slacking and who's not.
Oh,
and for
God.
Me, my heart rate doesn't go up easily. Like I can go pretty fast before I leave the green zone.
Yeah.
So
my heart rate is steady, like 42 beats a minute.
Good for you. Gee, what?
Yep, I'm a sleepy bear.
That's why your metabolism's so slow.
Yeah.
Well, that's healthy, though.
It's healthy, but sometimes it dips low. We've gone to the hospital like 3 times because I've just been like losing consciousness, and it's because like some weird mixture of things made it drop a little too low because you get sleepy when it gets too slow. And yeah, like throwing myself into cold water, being in the cold really helps. But like it is exhausting.
Huh.
It's very weird. My mom, I'd go to the doctor and I'd be like losing consciousness and they'd be like, they kept rechecking it and they were like, why is it at like 35 beats? Is she an athlete? And my mom would always be like, she's not an athlete. She is not.
Lance Armstrong over here. Gee whiz.
Isn't that weird?
That's wild.
Yeah. They say it's because it's big or something. So it's like an efficiency thing. I have no idea. It takes a long time for it to pump, which makes my hands and feet really cold. It's very strange. But I just did a thing. I did the same fucking thing. I'm boxing twice a week. I feel incredible. Add a day. And then next thing I know, I was walking from the VU to the cellar, and my legs were like tight, could barely, like, I was like walking like a Terminator. And I just was like, I had like a nervous breakdown right before Christmas. And I was like, I'm like doing shows all week, waking up, doing such extraneous exercise, not having any days off, going on the road, doing a crazy workout at the hotel. Like, and then I just like had to pull the reins and I was like, dude, I'm training with you 2 days a week. If I do it on the, you know, I'll do some, you know, soul cycle and cardio and running on my own. But like I had to like, cause I get so addicted. I'm an addict. So like as soon as I get into it, especially if I'm fresh off the breakup, I go fucking hard.
Yeah. And the more you do it, the more tired you feel. And then compulsion is a weird thing because it works. So the opposite of like the weaker you are, the more disciplined you become. Like when you break those guardrails in your mind that tell you when to stop, it's really hard to. There were so many times when I was just overdoing it where it was a moment where I was like, oh, I need sleep and I'm very anxious and riled up because I'm so tired. Let's go exercise instead.
Yeah.
And there were so many workouts that should have been naps.
Oh, so many workout naps. Or I'll be like in bed and it'll be after shows and I'll be like, okay, I'm going to train at noon. I have to walk the dog at 11. It's now 3 a.m. I'm counting. Okay, that's not enough time. And then I'm at training being like, and it was just like.
Oh, I ate too much. Let's go work out more. Yeah, let's go cancel it out. Now I go to the pool and I swim a bit. And the goal is on the healthy days, it's like I spent so many years not being a great swimmer and working really hard. And I'm like. It's not a coincidence. You were working against yourself for most of that. If you had slowed down and worked on technique and drills and actually not made it your goal to hurt yourself and leave every workout as tired as possible, you could have been a good athlete.
Yeah.
Or a better one, at least.
It's all a bizarre amount of self-harm. It is. Which I get that there's some aspect of the self-harm that is like, it's hard because our whole career is based off self-harm. I mean, we stay up until 1 a.m. in the morning doing whatever gigs will allow us to do them, right? It's like we're doing an hour of comedy in front of people, which is fun, but it is – then you do another hour, your voice – like it is all – we've learned that like in order to make it in this business, you have to harm yourself. You can't say no to gigs.
No.
You can't – you have to sleep on couches and all that. So
And weirdly, the voice in your head is the one that's most condemning.
Yeah.
Yeah. You'd think it would be, if you cancel a spot, you're like, well, what would the booker say? What would I say?
Yeah.
Taking a night off? Have you really earned it?
Yeah.
Really?
Totally.
You know who else is doing more spots than you tonight?
That night.
Yeah.
That night you get there and you're like, what am I doing? I'm sitting at home like a fat fuck. What the fuck? I could be doing a spot right now.
Or what if I was tired on stage and finally thought of the ending to that joke?
Yes, I do that all the time.
That could be the closer of my special.
And then I go and I'm so exhausted and I bomb my dick because I'm like, yeah, they're not visiting. And I'm like, I should have just called in. It's crazy.
What's the most reckless thing you've ever done in terms of overextending yourself with like a comedy set?
Great question. I will tell you. I did not know what Celsius was. I had no idea. I drank two, had a full panic attack, racing, speeding thoughts, couldn't slow them down, was breathing, was going to the bathroom, was shitting everywhere, I was just like sweating, panic attack, telling Jake, I was like, we have to cancel the shows. There's no way I can do it. And then I was like, no, I can do it. So I did 2 full hours experiencing a panic attack.
Wow.
Yeah.
That happened to Ismael. We were on a show together,
yes.
A panel show, and he was having a panic. And I was sitting next to him, and I was like, that was funny. He's like, I'm having a panic attack currently, and my mouth is kind of going through it somehow, but my brain is not here. I've had 2 panic attacks. I didn't realize how terrible they are.
They're the worst things, yeah. where you dissociate and you can hear your own voice through your voice.
Uh-huh. And there's
I almost gave – me and my mom were sitting up the other night talking, and I was trying to describe to her – what it was. I was like there's a fear that you get caught in the loop of your own brain and you can't get out of it. And I was like describing this fear, like you get stuck in the abyss that is your mind. And my mom started being like, is it like this? And she got herself so close to exactly what it is that she was like, I think this is the closest I've ever gotten to feeling panic, because she's just like an athlete and she was like, this is awful, I'm so sorry for you. And I was like, yeah, it's horrible, it's horrible. You can hear, you're here and their voice is talking, and then you pause for a second and wonder what would happen if you just melted down and passed out on stage, and you're like, do I ever speak again after this next word that comes out? It's crazy.
Jeez. I don't know, I had that severe of a one. To me, it felt like a wheel, like you just spin this wheel,
yeah,
and you let it spin and it should slow down, but instead of slowing up, it just keeps speeding up. Even when you stop feeding it, the inertia of it just keeps going, growing and growing and growing. You're like, I'm sitting here, none of these things are here even bothering me. I'm on a plane now. There's it's all gone. All the stress of missing this flight and the fight I had and all the panic I have about life. The feeling persists without the motivation, and it's terrifying.
That was what I felt. I have them on planes a lot. I actually have a theory that there's something with the airplanes, because I'll get on planes and I'll be like, oh, whoa, there's like a flicker of panic. And it's not the takeoff or landing. I think it is like some weird
altitude. It's claustrophobia. It's just cabin fever.
Yeah, but sometimes I'm like, it really comes. I've fainted on planes before out of the fucking blue, dude. I have passed out. I was like watching a movie that was so bad. There was a tiny bit of gore. And I was like, that was stupid. That looked like this. And then I just passed out. And I was like, whoa.
It's like your joke.
Yeah. What was the panic attack you had that spun the wheel? Oh, we're going to miss a flight.
No, it was, I was late. I mean, I always really freak out about flights. I just,
really?
Even when I've never missed one, but I'm always so freaked out on mornings where I have to like pack up and go and getting there and this train schedule. It's just a lot of stuff feels out of my control, and I have a very disproportionate response to it every time. And I always feel really drained afterwards. But I got in a fight with Laura about something. I said something that, you know, was taken the wrong way. And then I was like defending myself, but defending myself was somehow like, you know how fights go, where it's like me trying to defend myself somehow like furthers the insult that I lobbed at her. And I tend to have very negative emotional reactions to relationship conflict. I tend to like freak out about it and have like breakdowns over it sometimes.
Like breakdowns as in yelling, or breakdowns as in where you verbally describe everything like a robot?
Kind of both.
Really?
Where I sit there, I try to like, I'll sit there and be like, this is what's rationally happening. This is what's happening right now. Can you please explain to me why this is a problem? I don't think this is – I'll do that a little bit.
Oh, you go full autistic.
A little
you
bit. Go full, where my rational mind tries to grab on to all of it and then
– But
then,
do you say that stuff out loud?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then she'll fight me on like a – then we'll be, as it happens a lot, like we'll have a disagreement over one factual thing about it. And then I'm locked into that because I'm like, well, no, if we disagree on this thing, which I know is true and you were saying is not true, then this whole foundation
breaks
of this whole
fabric of logic.
Reality breaks for me. And I feel very panicked when that happens.
Yeah, totally.
And it's obviously between two people, there's 3 stories, right?
Yeah.
And I can understand it's not her trying to fuck with me. It's how she experiences it, remembers it. And I remember it differently. And I kind of really panic. And from her perspective, I'm this pedant prick just being like, it was actually 2 hours, not 3 hours, you know, like that.
I'm that person. I'm specifics person where I will obsess about these specifics. And then I think that every time they are not saying what is accurate, I'm like, now I know that you're delusional, mm-hmm. and now we really have a problem.
Yes.
Because you're bending the truth in order to have your way, which means we're not operating mm-hmm. on an equal basis. You're just like, you're making it whatever makes you win, which means we can't really be in a relationship mm-hmm. because this isn't going to be about winning. This is about finding common ground, and you've just like cheated mm-hmm. the game. Mm-hmm. And then I get violent. That's when I'll hit shit. When there's like a full, I mean, I've stopped hitting shit, but I would punch walls. Like when somebody would be like, that's just not what happened. I'm not going to say that's what happened. I would be like,
I get that's slicey.
We both had our cutting thing. Dude.
I stopped. I'm able to stop. I've had three phases of my life, and high school, college, and unfortunately, recently.
I've had with big breakups where somebody leaves abruptly. The feeling of I punch things now. That's mm-hmm. what my self cutting because it fucks up my hand.
Uh huh. I'll hit my face. I'll bang my chest. I'll slap myself really hard.
Yeah. Yeah. But in high school, it was definitely cutting. Now the problem with cutting, I can't cut. I would faint immediately.
Oh.
But I was so dissociated. And
it feels really good when you do it.
No, I used to do it, but now I would even think
about it. It solves all your problems very quickly and then creates worse ones later down the road.
Because the endorphins just hit?
I believe it's endorphins. The pain blocker, when you keep doing something painful, your body goes, well, you're not going to stop, so let's at least alleviate it so you can get through what you're going through. That's why running feels good.
That's why I don't like – I've had a lot of people who are like, oh, yeah, I found out that – you know, like my mom's friends have been like, can you talk to this person's kid? They found out they cut themselves. And it's like there's a point in every kid's life where they're like, this is my skin, and you don't get to tell me what to do with it. And this is – I need to find out what this feels like because everything in my power is telling me to hurt myself.
Mm.
And I don't think, I mean, a lot of people will throw their kid in front of a priest if they do it, but I think it's like a rite of passage.
You can't shame it. Yeah, I don't like the reason I think the second time I've ever talked about it publicly. It's I don't want to like glorify it anyway because it's hard to not talk about it in a way that like makes it seem appealing.
Yeah.
It's just an ugly thing. It becomes a pretty addictive thing and it ends with death in some cases, which is very unfortunate. I know it was very hard to manage myself, and I would not advise. I don't know, like, talk to a professional if it's something, whether it's something you're dealing with or somebody you know is dealing with. And when Laura discovered I was doing it, she was like, your therapist immediately, the next therapy session, you were talking to him about this. You were not letting this, and because I hadn't told my therapist, and she was like, you were talking to them, and you were figuring out how to do this, and we're going to create some accountability where you don't keep doing this to yourself.
Wow.
Uh-huh.
Where she found it on your body, or you were finally told her?
I think I finally told her.
And it was from typically fights where you felt trapped.
Among other things, but yes,
yeah.
It's horrible to say this because it sounds like this is my own problem with processing conflict that was leading to this. And it's
always relationships that do it. If we're on our own,
for me, the when I did it in high school, it was stress with work.
Oh, really?
With schoolwork, always being stressed about a paper and schoolwork and just not finding an escape of just, they need to do this thing and I'm not able to sit down to do it. And now it's 2 a.m. and I haven't written the first paragraph of this essay that's due tomorrow. And in college, it was social and romantic rejection. And also that I was kind of failing academically in college. I was just struggling so much because I went to a school that I might not have been smart enough for. Rice.
Oh, okay.
I was in over my head, and all the discipline I had in high school went away when I actually started getting invited to parties. In high school, I was a great student because I had no distractions because no one wanted me around. And when I went to college, I was like, oh, look at this. This is the parties are right here on my floor. I'm better looking now than I was, so I'm more socially accepted and romantically accepted. And I cared about that. I cared about swimming because I was very compulsive about swimming in college, and I was very compulsive about eating, and I would really starve myself in college and then over-exercise and then really break down and drink, but not to an extent that was like alcoholism, but to an extent that didn't help anything. I would stay up drinking and then wake up angry and go for like a 10-mile run, like just a lot of very bad behavior, and my academics really fell to the the thing that kind of slipped in all that. So,
and you think most of this has to do with the upbringing of being told that you're insufficient?
Not more than other people. Don't pity me, but I think my my mom could be at points very critical of me away, and she wanted the best for me. But I mean, there is a very carefully crafted cocktail of shame and encouragement that need to go into making someone their best self. And
now you're in the most in the career that is exactly. I mean, this career is like, I mean,
insane.
You can choose your own path, and you get like, I'm doing this podcast, which is not a comedy podcast. It's like a, you know, and people could be like, that's not a comedy podcast. Right. But I'm like, this is something I have to do in order to make this career not feel like I'm a fucking clown all the time. And but it is also, you get on stage and it is, was that good or was that not good? I mean, it's crazy.
Was I good or was I bad?
Right.
Do they like me or do they not?
Yeah.
We need unequivocal verbal validation every 12 seconds or we fall apart. It's such a toxic thing to pursue.
Yeah. But it's also good practice. I mean, it's sometimes to get off stage after knowing they don't like you and being like, man, I have to just figure out how to right now accept that I am myself, that they didn't like me, and I have to love myself. It's really hard. And it used to be like, I would
I'm
get
not
off stage.
There yet.
Yeah.
A bomb, I'm just like, this is going to hurt until I have a good set. That's how it goes.
I am like that. I've gotten a little bit better recently because it's almost like, I'm going to take big swings every time so that I can pretty much blame that swing for if it didn't go well.
I do. And I'm a good little boy and I do everything right and they still don't like me. And that feels terrible.
But also when you do a set where you're like, they like me, and then a set, like I'll do the same room and one is, likes me and one doesn't. Or I'll do the same set in two different rooms. Mm-hmm. And that also helps me be like, okay, this is just like...
Yeah, that happened to me last night. I had a bad set in the VU, and then I went over to, first on both shows, the bar, and the crowd was just so much there for me. It felt so great. Greg Stone made me realize something that I need to do more often. If you have multiple sets in the night, you always want to take a risk on the first set, and then you end up going very safe on the next set because you bombed and you just want to win.
Yeah.
We should be doing the opposite. If you have multiple sets in the night, first set, kill. So you can feel good about yourself. So then you can take the risk on the next show because you have the confidence in yourself to take those risks and maybe still make it funny anyway. This is just something I'm playing with. But
yeah, the problem is when I do that and I kill, then the next one I do something weird and then I condemn myself for that weird thing forever.
But whatever. Doing the weird thing on the first show, it's spitting in the Petri dish. You don't know if it was them or you because you started the night weird versus if you do the first show well, you go, I'm funny. Good to remember that. I did well. This crowd likes me. I want to do the safe stuff. Now I'm going to be able, just to do something weird. And
do you ever find that there's moments like in, I don't know if people have this in their careers, but I always feel like there's like epochs of my life where sometimes I'm so highly, it might just be mania, but sometimes everything is super vivid. I'm right there. I'm in the moment. And then there will be like a month or so where I am slightly hovering. Like, it'll be on stage. There'll be, like, a month will go by where I'm, like, fucking with it. No matter what white trash is in the audience, I'm connecting. I'm learning about them. And then there'll be months where I'm just, like, say the jokes and get off the stage. And I notice that it translates to other aspects of my life. Like, I'll be like, oh, yeah, this also I'm dissociating. You know, like, I'll be eating food and I'll be like, oh, right now I really just want, like, a turkey stick and a, you know, sweet potato to get through the day. And other times I'll be like, oh yeah, during that time where I was present, I was like going out to dinner. And it feels like I take a break from life for a month at a time sometimes where I just check out. And that can really have an impact on stage.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it works because there's apathy behind it, which can be
sometimes
attractive.
Sometimes you have food poisoning, you have the best set of your life.
Yeah.
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 It's weird how there's that level, you know?
Yeah. When you just looked at the devil in the eye. Yeah, totally.
I do very well after fights.
Oh, me too. After I get dumped? Holy shit.
Or just with like, if Laura and I have a conflict and, like, I get on stage and it's this, the person who knows me best in this world doesn't like me right now, there's nothing you can do to me. You can't make me, you barely know me, and if you dislike me, I don't give a fuck. This person.
When I'm PMSing, it's the best.
Yeah.
It's the best.
I don't relate to your epoch thing. For me, I'm a little more like, am I sleeping enough? Am I traveling too much? Am I spending too much time doom scrolling? Those three things are most of my problems. And then my discipline falls apart from there and I tend to spiral. The more tired I am, the later I go to sleep, the more I spend on my phone, the more I hate myself, the more I don't take risks on stage. And then when I'm like active and healthy but not overdoing it. But maybe you do need a little bit of the turbulence to spur the good comedy.
Yeah. I'm,
just
like,
that recklessness.
Yeah. Like sometimes I'll be on stage and I'll be like, there's nothing activating me super intensely right now about like my set will be I'll like be observing things about people, but there will be nothing that's like making me fucking furious, and I'll find the set to be a little lackluster because I'm not in the mode of
you need some big emotion.
Yeah, totally. Or else it's not it's not good, which means that every set I go up, I'm like, okay, think of the thing that you're really agitated or that you're really thinking about or you think is so funny right now. And sometimes I'm like, I'm chilling.
I'm the op. I need to be just playful and fun.
Really?
I don't like to, I don't pull from the extremes of emotion. I think I'm, my best self on stage is just a bit more happy-go-lucky.
Yeah.
And even in the, when the moments get severe, the fun part is the pull back into the look at this painful thing, but look how silly we are right now. And look how much fun we're having right now looking back at this painful experience. Like,
I think that is the answer, actually. I think the answer to not being activated is be silly.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there are times where I'm so sleepy or that I'm just like so loopy.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually think that the apathy could be put into the, I think that I actually could transform it a little bit into almost like high silly, which is a set that I love doing. I love doing where I'm almost seems like I'm high.
Yeah.
That is very fun.
Yeah.
And I think I could do that. Even transform the resentment of I'd rather be home in bed than here into I'll just bring you into bed with me and we'll giggle.
That's smart.
Yeah.
One of the most like moving performances I've ever seen was I opened for Bert on the road and he was about to do a special and the stuff was getting really tight. And on a Monday or a Tuesday night, we just pop into Madison and he has 2 sold out shows at Comedy on State just so he can just get loose and run into the club before he does it in one of his giant theaters or arenas, which is where the only place he can do is ours now because he's gotten so big. And he went up and just had the goofiest, loosest set. It was stories within stories. And like that secret time thing he has is the best cheat code. Well, he'll be saying something, secret time, and then he'll tell you, and then he'll do a secret time within a secret time. And it'll be like sidebar.
Note, side note. Yeah. I always go side note.
And I know his act, so I know he is really just off script and just exploring things. And when the crowd really thinks that you're taking him on this bespoke side quest that was not planned, the energy in the room and the energy they give you and give them back is just this cyclotron. It just keeps building and building and building. And it's so cool to be that loose. But then the other side of that, you do need structure. You do need jokes. You need to know where your punchlines are. You need to know where you're starting and your beginning.
Especially to record this hour. I mean, I'm recording in May and I'm like, I got it.
First hour.
And my whole thing is go on stage and be fucking insane. And I open the loop. I close the loop. I'm good at closing the loops once I open the loops. But it is, I am trying to figure out how to make it seem like every single story I'm just gleaning right now, which is how I usually do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then
that Louis trick, have the discovery in the moment.
Yeah. It's
every time. Yeah.
It's so hard. You have to really just be practiced.
Yeah. And somehow feel it as well. I mean, keep it loose, keep it tight. It's that.
Yeah.
That paradox of.
It's pretty sick, though. I mean, it's good for people like you and me who have a very overactive brain that's constantly trying to destroy. I mean, I'll lay awake and I'll be like, I can't sleep. And then I'll be like, all right, deconstruct your set. And then I'll fall asleep.
Because
I'm just, there's constant places where I can,
you build puzzle. So much within things. You can just find ways to keep expanding things. It's brilliant to watch. And I never know what's the script and what's not. And that's to me the best because that's something I can never achieve. Rarely can I like go off script and really keep the crowd with me in a way that's where you don't know what starts and what begins the material. How much of this hour of yours is like, how scripted is it going to be? Are there going to be things you really do in that moment that are just really weird and off? Are you going to flip the order while you're there? Or is it going to be?
I don't know.
Uh-huh.
That's what I'm figuring out.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. Cause do I want to put the closer in the middle? Then what would be
don't ever think that part.
Yeah.
Of it. Well, that was just my decision. Cause I just wanted the set that was the most fun to perform. I knew that was really mattered was, am I having fun the whole time? Am I doing it in an order in which I stay engaged?
Yes.
Because that part will be the most obvious thing you see, not the jokes.
Yeah, the only way I can do that is to not have an order.
Mm-hmm.
If there's an order, I mean, I think I should.
Or your eyes go dead and you're pantomiming expressions, but it's just uncanny human imitation. Yeah. I would say my advice to you, and not that I have any right to give it to you, is just do whatever will cause you to have the most fun, because going back and looking through all the clips now, I'm like, I'm like, what a gift my past self gave to me, that is me genuinely enjoying that joke.
Oh, yeah.
Nothing can replicate that.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter if I got the timing and the words perfect. Here's me actually having fun and like having real little moments in it that weren't planned, that aren't part of the joke every time I tell it. Yeah. That is what I think people want to see a bit more of.
Totally. It's just my fear is sometimes I'll lose a thread and then I have to get it back. You know, but I think
there is editing.
When
you have five or seven cameras,
I have to remember the editing.
Some fun stuff.
Yeah, I think I just need to. I think it is true that I have these, you know, the three big segments, and how I get to each one, I need to just kind of let be up to the whim, because I know they one opens the other, and then it opens another, and then it closes, and then you know. But the finding the perfect through line. It all has a through line. I don't need to like sew everything together perfectly. I think.
What are the three parts? PMS.
The three parts are plastic surgery in general.
Mm-hmm. So normalized, but
yeah, so normalized. Very scary.
Really weird.
What's the other one? The dad sexuality stuff, and then the last one, the last big thing is waxing.
Oh, yes. God, I love that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, the waxing one is a big thing that opens on itself. And then the through line through it all is this feeling of, like, creature-like, like, not feeling like a it's like the idea of self-love and how ridiculous that is. That's, like, the whole through line, which they all lead to each other. And, you know, I know roughly where they go, but I'm obsessing about how to start right now. And I'm literally doing the thing where you're like, oh, my God, I finally can give myself – I can shut my OCD off and just focus on this chunk. And then – like, Ari Shaffir was like, take your best stuff, you know, move it to the end, work on the stuff that's the weakest, perfect that until that's your best, then move the next ones up, which is like – I'm like, this is the most satiated. It's like doing a logic equation where it's just like, this is – all I want to be doing.
I remember that when I started out, how a joke, you're like, oh, this joke's good. And I'll start opening with it because I need something to open with. And you're like, isn't it weird how it just makes itself better?
Yeah, yeah.
When you open with a joke enough, it will, you, without consciously doing it, you will find every B joke that is not worthy of its place there.
Yeah.
If we work out the joke later in the set, when you have momentum, you'll have all this fluffy stuff and these little tags and these beats that'll kind of just slow it down. Even though they get a laugh, it kind of slows down the next laugh, it slows down the next laugh. Versus when you put it up front, you're like, good, but not good enough. Let's get beat, 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 boom.
It's hard, though, opening with my shit, because I usually lube them the fuck up by jerking them off with crowd work, by literally sucking their cocks with crowd work, introducing them to my...
I've always gone in dry. You know me.
Yeah.
I go straight into the fucking...
I know,
fucking,
you go dry, and I'm so envious of that.
It's so hard. Well, it's just hard, and I bomb a lot because of it.
And sometimes crazy.
It's just sometimes I'm just really, like, stacking bricks. It's so hard to build
you
them up with jokes.
I don't know how to do crowd work. It's crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
I walk on stage and I'm like, I need you guys to all know me.
Uh-huh.
And then when I talk about wanting to fuck my dad, then you won't be as freaked out.
Yeah.
What do you open? Like, you'll just go up and be like, you don't say anything. You don't say, I can't.
I try to find a moment every time. If I can find a moment about the room or the comic who was just on, anything gives me so much more depth as a comic. Like any little thing where that just happened, or
what do you,
like,
do if you don't have that? Like, what's the first thing you'll say?
I'll just do I live in New York City, joke about New York City. That's it.
So just I live in New York City out the gate.
Yeah.
I would have to,
I live just something, but not enough, clearly. And I want to get looser because I'll write a lot more if I write less. If I just go up there and get loose, I'll find a lot more. That's when I, like, even if it doesn't work, I go, but I was excited to talk about that. And the crowd was excited to hear about that. So let's go visit that, because that's all we need. Plus a punchline and we're there.
What happens when you do crowd work? You're just dead in the water?
I'm dead in the water. I don't listen very well. I get nervous. I choke up. Yeah. Sometimes it's great. Sometimes I can have a quick response. And I've learned the big trick for me is keep asking questions and don't rush for a joke if it's not there.
Yeah.
That's
it's just
the biggest
curiosity.
Mistake.
It's
curiosity.
It's like,
and then
somebody
repeat back what they say.
And I'm like, that was boring. Next.
Yeah.
And then if that person has something interesting, then I keep.
And there's some nights where I'm just being very, that's a fun thing when you're just being very authentic and it's getting laughs. And you're like, I don't know why, but cool. Where I'm just kind of just saying, like, genuinely how I feel and something that excites me.
Yeah.
A lot of times I get excited about very tedious things. And I think that can be entertaining to crowds. I think that's kind of a lot of my acts.
Yeah. What are the tedious things? What are some?
I just get excited about, like, etymology and words and names and numbers and just those kind of minute connections between things.
Yeah.
I love, like, the history of a word.
Yeah, me too. I get into that a lot. Mm-hmm. You know what I just found out? I just found out is that scrupulosity.
That's a word?
Means, yes, it means when you have obsessive compulsive disorder around religion.
Huh.
Yeah.
I know unscrupulous means someone who is lacking in morals.
Right, and to be scrupulous is something.
I wonder if it comes from the word scripture, if it has any link to that.
Oh, maybe.
But scruples. Oh, I use that. Yeah, scruples is...
Scrupulosity.
I have that as a punchline and a joke. I could do that, too, if I had sufficient resources and minimal scruples or something like that.
Scruples is like a beef? Beef with something?
No, scruples is... values. I knew it as like, oh, that man has no scruples. He'll sell to anyone. He has no scruples.
Scruples means values?
Uh-huh. He has no principles. He has no, like, a person lacking scruples is a person who is, like, willing to do shady shit.
Really?
That's how I know it to be, but I could be
so
wrong.
So that's what
I,
that
I talk
means.
With
it's
a lot
gotta
of authenticity.
Be from that. Scrupulosity has to be
But
from...
I could see the link to religion.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I know a lot of people with OCD around religion.
Mm-hmm.
And my friend found out that it's called that, which is amazing.
Interesting.
Yeah. Like a lot of people, if they grow up religious, will just be like, God is, I'm going to hell if I don't do this. I'm going, and then they have to do the things in order to not go to hell. And
oh, that's such a funny bit. What if Catholicism wasn't a religion? It was just one guy with OCD.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we must count the rosary beads and we must recount them. And you're like,
yeah. Hasidics? Have you seen the things they do? I'm like, this is, yeah.
Praying five times a day?
Yeah. It's OCD.
All religion, it's just untreated OCD. Wow. Yeah. What a revelation.
Yeah.
Why? So you like opening with crowd work. Does it ever fail you? Do you ever just like, wow, this is going nowhere, and then your material saves you?
Yeah, so sometimes it'll be boring, but, you know, usually it's – there is a genuine – I do feel very alienated until I at least connect with somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Or connect with the room. Like, I can connect with the room and be like, the vibe is weird in here. You guys are drunk. I got that. Balcony, y'all are too fucked up. But I have to, like, connect in some way, or else it's just, like, I tried doing it last night where I was like, you're going to open with this, 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 and this to just try to see if you can raw dog it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just odd. Mm-hmm. I wasn't myself. I talked in a more feminine voice. I got more against the wall. Like, I was a little bit more like, like, I have to really be like, you here, we're together, I'm doing this. Because if I just jump into it, I feel like I'm... Yeah, there's no lube.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I started in an era where with older comics ran the scene in Houston. The club owner was like a Vegas guy, and the other guys did the road, and it was so built around get your late night set, get your audition set, get your JFL set. And I tend to really gravitate towards like structure and rigor and routine.
I know.
It's
awesome.
So I loved having what can I say every night that gets a laugh? And for first, what? 8 years of comedy, I would say, hi, I look like a douchebag.
Yeah.
And that was just enough to kind of get it started most nights.
When I did my late night set, it was so weird. I had to kind of address the audience. Like, I had to be like, hi, I'm going through a breakup. Fuck. Like, and then I had to yell at them. Like, I said something like, shut up. Like, something like that. I forget what it was, but it was something where I addressed them.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't. And it was very weird. It felt very Twin Peaks-y.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On my special, my first joke was a joke about Sean Donnelly, who brought me on.
Great.
And then I did 4 minutes of jokes about New York City. And then I said to the crowd, that's not going in the special. We're going to cut that out. And then I started what started the special. But the special started with the laugh and me going, that's not going on the special. And then I started first joke. Because you can do that. You can have the moment in the room.
Yeah.
And then start the material. And then that's where the viewer joins you. It's something, I don't know if you've considered it, but like...
Yeah, that's
you can do whatever you want to like get that crowd work, get that connection with the crowd before you start this hour.
Oh yeah, we'll fuck around.
Yeah,
I'll have to fuck around.
Uh huh.
It'll be weird.
Of course.
But yeah, it is. The other thing is, I also have the OCD where I'm like this whole bit is so scary and triggering and weird. Right, whatever I'm working on is so jarring that I'm like, I need to see if it can go in without lube, and if it can't go in without lube, I have to put lube in it.
Mm-hmm.
I can't just do crowd work so that lube takes it, because what will happen is if you're watching the special, you know, it'll open on that and you'll be like, whoa, I am out of here. This girl is nuts. So I'm like, I have to make this somehow more civilized if I'm going to go in hard like this. Or I start the special with civilized shit, which is not going to hook anybody at all because it's too civilized.
I think your civilized shit is
still pretty uncivilized.
Still pretty fucking good.
Okay, cool.
I think you're great. I think, yeah, I think you'll be, I think people like you a lot. And I think whatever you think is not as interesting is still extremely interesting. And
it's so.
I would personally say don't take the risk of going, like, I had plenty of jokes in my special that were like, you're going to need 10 minutes of me at least before you can trust me to go down this route.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. The Hartsfield Jackson story about my mom. Have you heard that one about her? She was arguing with an attendant and said, let me speak to your master.
What?
You haven't heard that one? What? She forgot the word manager. It's a really good story. The fun part was I didn't
that
have to make
that could have gone in first.
No fucking way. And like that didn't even work on one of the tapings. The first taping it worked, and I was like, good, because this fails half the time. Half the time there's more tension than release, and then half the time it's the perfect balance. God, what a fun joke to tell.
Wait, where was she when she said it?
The Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport, Atlanta.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
She said that?
She said
that. Were they black? No.
The joke was, it's the Atlanta airport.
Wow.
Yeah, so, yeah.
That's
They
so...
were all black. And then the response was strong but fair from them. And she ended up not getting on the flight because of how much of a argument she got into.
Really?
Truly.
They said, take me to your master is so funny. And she was like, I didn't mean it.
I want people I go through
okay,
all this in the special. Should I leave
oh,
it?
Really?
I will answer that.
No, go through
I think
it
you'll
special.
Get a satisfactory inventory of all the things that occurred. I tried to answer
Hell
all the
yeah.
questions. But that was a really fun story to tell. You know what's weird? That joke works. I mean, this won't surprise you. That joke works so much better when there are black people in the room.
Yeah.
And not that I like monitor people, but I've looked around during that joke and from what I've experienced, black people, I think, tend to say, yeah, this is my experience. He's saying the kind of shit that happens
it's
to us.
It's insane that people would clam up on it. That's
yeah,
insane.
White
it's not
people
you,
do.
It's your mom. It's like
right.
crazy. Yeah.
And then in Canada, it works way better than America. And I think it's because, and obviously I'm performing to white people in Canada and the places I'm going, in Winnipeg. But I think in Canada, they don't feel that sense of guilt for the state of things that white Americans do.
I used to do this joke about how I lived, you know, I lived with Mike and Ethan.
Uh-huh.
And how Mike would like, I would be like, I know that racism is like ingrained because
mm-hmm.
Mike would like hide and jump out with like a knife and I wouldn't. And I would be like, sit down, bitch. And Ethan would just like walk into the kitchen and I'd be like, Jesus Christ. yeah. And sometimes people get so weird about it. And then the other...
See, that to me is such a good place for a joke.
Yeah.
It's like, let's acknowledge this is bad, but let's acknowledge this is real.
And so funny. I mean, Ethan would fuck around with it. So he would come up to me at bodegas and be like, hey, and I'd be like, ah! And he would try and get me. He also is a nurse and is a very soft walker, but he's a very quiet. He's
sneaky footed.
But yeah, I try and talk about my mom, how she will be like, she like is we're from Ithaca where it's so white.
Mm-hmm.
So as soon as she's like in a conversation with like one of my black friends, it'll basically be like 4 seconds before she says something about them being black.
I'm the same way.
Are you
I can't help it, man. It's just so interesting. You have this completely different experience in this world that
feels.
I'm completely blind to. And I would love to understand what in my life is actually arbitrary and not everyone's lived experience.
That's exactly what she says,
yeah.
But it translates to, hi, black.
Yeah.
You should talk to her.
I was listening to hip-hop recently.
Yeah. Yeah. She's like, well, as an African-American, going to that school must have been really something. And mm-hmm. Yes.
And also, we're around comedians, and I've noticed, I don't know, it's Seller, it's just like, it's what they want to talk about, too. If
yeah,
someone's
yeah,
gay,
totally.
They want to talk about being gay. If someone's whatever,
yeah.
Tibetan, they want to talk about that. And we
yeah.
all want to talk about our experiences and what's normal and what's not.
Yeah.
I think some of our, I think, you know, Caleb Sinan?
No.
Really funny comic from Atlanta. Came up with Roland, now lives in L.A. And he grew up in like nowhere, Georgia. And he would talk about, he has a joke about how growing up in elementary school, they would play soccer at recess. And the teams would just divide themselves into black and white. They would just play black versus white as children.
Like
they
the
drew
tables
these lines.
At the Comedy Cellar.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And someone had to tell him that this wasn't normal. He was just like, you know, we were playing blacks, whites, soccer. And they're like, what?
Oh, my God. That's so
And
funny.
He didn't know how funny it was. Someone had to be like, you have to talk about that. So
it seems also dangerous for the white kids.
Yeah.
Wow, that's awesome. So we talked about it.
I think he said it on his Conan set. It's a great joke. Caleb Sinan, look up the joke if you're,
oh,
if
that's
you're
great.
Curious. But
yeah, I have a whole chunk about how about race in mine, which is all good because it's all talking about how white people are inherently cringe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a safe way.
It's very safe.
It is weird because, you know, some of the best comedy of the 90s and 2000s, 80s, 90s, 2000s was black people breaking apart white culture in a way that we were blind to see.
Yeah.
And then white people started talking about white people in a way that made that all cringe.
Yeah.
It made it uncomfortable. So it's good to see when people can do it well.
Yeah. I know. Yeah. It's brutal when
it's
you're
brutal.
Like,
white people, I know, like, I'm white. And you're like, yeah. Oh, you're not in on it.
Oh, I hate that. Yeah. Where they're like, that's a white girl speaking. Yeah, yeah. Totally.
I'm going to talk to your manager. Like,
yeah. Mine is about how, yeah, is about white men are a little. Or it's more like white men, when left to their own devices, will get really scary. Like, it came out of when I went to the Fish concert, mm-hmm. and I stood on stage and I was like, how many people, are there any black people here? Zero. And I was like, oh, that's why you guys are dressing like this. That's why you're wearing bedazzled makeup and little fairy wings and little Salt Life hats and like flip flops, is because no black guys are going to come within a mile of this horrible music and be like, what the fuck are you guys doing? You know?
Oh, to scare people away, or because they're free to dress that way?
To scare people. They're not going to come to near the music. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, because white people just will dress like idiots if no black people are there to be cool around them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
white people always want to impress black people.
Always, yeah. Inherently. Like, yeah. When I lived in Nashville, we'd go two-stepping, and it was like prairie girl dresses and like guys who would slick their hair back. And I'd be like, I can't do this. And they'd be like, why? And I was like, what if a black dude walks in? What if a cool black guy with Nikes walks in and I am getting spun by some idiot with a folded bandana in his pocket? I won't have it. I'll be humiliated.
I am caught up in, I'm probably going to put my foot in my mouth here, but I'm caught up in how young white men right now just so openly do an impression of black people.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It is bonkers to me, because I grew up
where that would get your shit kicked in. Yeah,
I grew up loving black people so much, and out of respect, I don't try to imitate it.
Yeah,
I don't wear Jordans because I'm not cool enough. I respect that. I'm not going to be a rapper because it's like, I'm not going to do that as well.
Yeah.
That's not my thing. You guys did that really well. Out of respect, I'm going to try to like stay over here and not do anything that is appropriative or.
You mean the Gen Zers dressing like with their oversized Nikes and their big t-shirts and all of that stuff, like the attire.
And chains, and just straight up doing a black scent. And we could, I'm not going to name comics, but you fucking know.
Yeah, yeah.
And like. I want to ask more black people, like, are you cool with this?
Yeah.
Is this an homage or is this like a rude imitation?
The best is when there's a black host and then a white comic gets on stage and accidentally code switches a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, I've probably done that. That's Quentin Tarantino's it.
yeah, totally. Totally. And then I've had that happen where it was like the first time I like met Louis, is it happened so hardcore. Will Sylvince got on stage. White comic got on stage, did full black scent, and I just turned, and Louis C.K. was just looking at me going, no. And I was like, I see it. Mm-hmm. It was so brutal.
Dude, it's hard to not do Louis when I'm on a show with Louis. It's such an easy, we all do a little bit of Louis.
Him last night.
Uh-huh. And it's like you're going crazy in your head.
Yeah. And I just was like, he talked about fucking his dad, and then I talked about wanting to fuck my dad with right back to back.
His is different though, right? His is about how he got fucked by his dad.
And I just had to use it. Like I could, I just had to acknowledge that he had said that, and then that, and be like, that reminds me of this.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's also, I'm so glad that I'm a woman, because for the first 4 years of comedy, I was doing a straight Louis impression. I was watching him writing my own jokes and then going up on stage.
Yeah.
Watching him writing my jokes. And I just got away with it because whenever a man does it, you're like, Jesus. But when a woman does it, you don't.
Jesus.
Yeah.
What's his name? Harris.
Which is, by the way, a Louis impression.
Jesus Christ. And then he gets his R's really raspy. And Harrison Tweed had a great bit for a little while that was in 2017, where he's like, it's weird watching comics go on stage and condemn what Louis did while also unknowingly doing a Louis impression.
Yeah.
Like, can you imagine masturbating in front of your coworker?
Yeah. You're jerking off.
You're jerking off.
You're like, hey, go over there. It's really crazy. It happens so much of this stuff. And I've been standing with Louis and I've seen somebody doing a direct impression and I've been like, do you see what I see? Mm-hmm. And he's like, dude, it's literally me or Burr. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, it's so many. He's mm-hmm. like, go to Boston. Mm-hmm. See how every one of them is doing Burr.
No, everyone. Well, Mark, who have been the most? Mark Norman was a very common impression.
Gillis, this?
Gillis, now everyone's doing Gillis.
I have slipped in
I
Gillis.
Started doing that, too, just because I have back pain. Yeah. I don't do this. I try to not do that, but just sometimes my hand's behind my back, which I got from Bargatze first, but...
Oh, yeah, Bargatze. Yeah, there's people who do Bargatze, too. The Gillis, I'll do this. Gay. I'll do this with just Gillis.
Yeah.
The look down. Yeah.
Yeah.
And like, then, is that bad?
And the Mulaney for years. So many Mulaneys.
Oh, yeah.
So many Mulaneys. Still Mulaneys. Kinane for a little while, was sad, because Kinane never got that famous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was Kinane? Just screaming?
The little voice right here, I'm a sad guy. I drink every night.
Oh, yeah, wow.
Yeah, yeah. Just the whole thing. I'm a bearded weirdo and just a sad white middle-aged white guy. Even Kinane talked about it, where he said, like, he was such a sad guy for his first two specials, and then everyone kind of stole that sad, whimsical kind of character. And he said he changed his things to make all of his jokes start from a positive place.
Yes,
because he was so annoyed with how much people had. I'm putting words into his mouth, but how popular that style had become, he shifted his style. Which to me is a mark of a great comic, when you become so good that people imitate you and then you find a new voice.
Yeah.
Wow.
Wait, that was Kinane?
Kinane, yeah. Mulaney's done that. Mulaney's also changed his voice away from the imitation people do of him currently.
Yeah, Louis was the one who told me. He was like, if you hate something, say that you love it. And
yeah.
I was like, wow.
That helps me write jokes.
Yeah, me too.
Defend this thing.
Yeah.
Or you hate this thing, or if you love this thing, why do you hate it?
Yeah.
And that's often an easier way to write.
Yeah.
But you can barrel straight at things. I don't have that ability with jokes. You can just feel a way about a thing and then just talk about it, whereas I have to have like a path to flip it over a couple times.
But I have to feel a way. Like, I can't make a joke about that tissue box. I mean, maybe I could, but I can't. I have to feel very strongly about a thing. And, and if I don't, then it's just I am talking out 3 feet outside of my head about something I don't care about. Like, I have to be passionate about it.
Hmm.
Whereas I can't, you know, I could not. I would be a horrible writer for somebody else.
You can turn, you'd be surprised. You can turn on a part of your brain when you're writing for someone else that becomes... You become an accountant. You become like, it turns into a desk job. Everything turns off. And yeah.
That's fair.
And then sometimes you write a joke you like, and then they don't take it. And you're like,
Yeah. That's nice.
Yeah, that's a fun feeling.
Have you gotten paid to do that a bunch?
I write for a couple people.
That's awesome.
For different things, yeah.
Does it pay well?
It pays fine. It's like, but it's very easy work. It's oftentimes a writing just means being in a group thread, a group text.
Oh, cool.
Mm-hmm. And podcasts and little things, or just submitting jokes for whatever, never for stand-up. Most people are pretty particular about their own stand-up when people need jokes for something.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool, it's though. Cool. It is the cool. It's the like biggest compliment.
Yeah.
Yeah, and punching stuff up is really, that's really fun. But I can be a little stubborn with my own voice, which can be a problem. I tend to like, this is the way the joke should be, and I have a very kind of, I feel like I'm very like, I want it to be, there's a structure I really love. The structures I really love, and it needs to be that. If it's anything less, it's I can't even see it as a joke sometimes.
I know you have like a category. You have like Immanuel Kant's categorization of jokes. I mean, you've like one time you were like, "That's a this kind of joke. That's a this time of joke. This is like you've created your own system of."
There's like 9 of them.
Yeah. What are the 9? I love this.
Misdirection and
listeners,
pun.
Listeners, I'm really sorry if this is too inside baseball, but I'm really enjoying it.
Everyone loves the inside of comedy now. It's just
Do they?
Fully. I mean, Kill Tony's the biggest podcast in the world, which is like a deconstruction of comedy.
Oh, okay. You Interesting.
Know?
Yeah.
Pun and misdirect are kind of the simplest forms. And as the simplest forms, they usually suck, but when they're good, they can be sublime. Comparison, hyperbole. I would have to categorize, I would say, sensorial. Which is when you can kind of pull cross, synesthetic might be the better word, of where you can actually kind of cross feelings, like it's so loud I could smell it, that kind of thing.
Okay.
I can't remember the rest. And then to me, the highest form, my favorite, is paradox / recursion, which is a logical fallacy that causes the idea to loop over. It's being like, this statement is a lie. It's not a great joke, but it causes your brain to kind of keep repeating the information until it catches it in a loop, and then you stop and laugh.
Like what?
I'm going to use someone else's joke here.
Okay, perfect.
J.P. McDade, fucking fantastic comic.
Yeah, he's amazing.
He goes, my name is J.P. McDade. The J.P. is actually, it's after my parents. It stands for J.P.'s parents.
That's great.
That's recursion, yes. Because within the J.P. there's a J.P. And then like it works on more, that's a more like very literal level, but that can happen within other concepts. Symmetry, that's a big one. People use symmetry a lot. Symmetry, irony is one category, where it's just a thing that the the thing introduced is also reflective of the structure of the broader thing over it. I have the Queer Eye joke I have where Laura was like, oh, this show is just men taking the advice women had given them for years. And I go, I don't think that's true. And then my friend goes, actually, men tend to dismiss more ideas when they hear them from women. And I go, wow, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
That's the symmetry of the two with the structure within the structure. That's dramatic irony in that I don't know something that the audience does. That's another device.
Mine is just stories.
I would say within every laugh you get, there's maybe something. But a lot of times, I think so. A lot of times it's comparison. And I think a joke is something that might not be the broadest thing, but it's first of all, data compression. It's because you've said so little and it unpacks so much. You need that for any joke. It's a small amount of words that evokes a large amount of information in your brain. But oftentimes it's just by things that are very disparate, very far away, and that you could show, say, hey, here's this and here's this. They don't seem very similar. Watch. Now they're the same thing.
Oh, okay. Yes.
And that's where comparisons and simile and metaphor are very useful.
I do a lot of I went for this out. I went in to have this happen, and this came out of it.
Mm-hmm. That's story structure, and that's a completely different. I'm just talking about the individual laughs. What words evoke laughter?
Specific laugh
usually has something to. It can usually explain what. And any good joke is using two devices. Any good joke is probably two things at once.
Cool.
I think. And this is obviously descriptive, not prescriptive. It's not something you would actually sit down and use to write a joke. That would not yield the best results going through that mechanical process of building jokes this way. But when you look at a joke, you can look back at it and go, ah, I think it works because of these two things. And maybe if that's what's working in it, what can I enhance to make that even pop a little harder?
Okay.
And also like simple things you can't do. Either you can't do too many puns or too much wordplay.
A therapist joke, just because I've already burned this joke. I forget what it was. The therapist, I don't like because they always talk bad about. I'm too Italian to go to therapy because they always talk bad. I can't remember it. About my mom. I'm always like. Something like that. Something like. Fuck you. I'll fuck your mother. Or something like that. My mom's an angel. Fuck. I can't remember it. It was on something.
That's a good impression. And that's a good. I would say there's a disparity between the person, the feminine woman we see on stage and Tony Soprano, how you transform into a character.
Yeah, what's that called?
I don't know. That's maybe in the impression realm, but like, I would say that's two disparate entities, you and Tony Soprano, and how you become one in this very specific moment. How
okay.
You are otherwise not like him, and then suddenly you become very much like him, is a shock to all of us.
I'm trying to think of my like shortest jokes.
I mean, little things like that. Whatever, pubic hair looking like all the things it looks like. Those are really good comparisons.
That's impression. Oh, comparison.
That's comparison. That's, okay. That's simile. It's like simile, metaphor, comparison. Yeah, I think you can do like good comics rely heavily on comparison. You look at like Bill Burr. Everything is it's like this. It's like this. It's like that. It's like that. It's like this. It's like that. But the like I'm not saying what makes a good backbone of good comedy. A good backbone is an authentic perspective. Good stories. Surprising takes on things.
You think could be deconstructed into this?
I think any words that evoke laughter,
yeah,
typically fall. There's a reason, right? There's not many things that there are things that get a laugh for no reason, and those are great. Those are the best jokes to me when I can't figure out why it's funny.
Yeah.
Uh huh.
Totally.
Or paradox recursion. Here's a better example. Not better example, but a notable one is Dimitri Martin. A guy walks up to him at a show and says, at a parking lot, goes, "Hey, you're Dimitri Martin." I go, "Yeah." He goes, "Can I be in one of your jokes?" I said, "Sure. How about this one?"
Oh, that's good.
That's paradox and recursion because it's
yeah. That's meta. It's mm-hmm.
Meta. That's another category as well. Anytime a joke takes a step back and looks at itself.
Yeah, I think mine.
Which is also weirdly meta can be a very low form of humor. If you ever watch new comics, they all say a joke and then talk about that joke, and it's kind of like
totally.
It's like how people who are new in comedy talk more about being a comedian versus the people who are established comedians barely talk about it.
Yeah. Wow. Wait. So it's so funny that now we're talking about I can't remember any of my jokes, but that's
it's
because
funny.
I don't think they have any structure. I think I'm just saying things. I mean, it's just things that occur. A lot of it is, here's how something's normal. Here's how I'm completely outside of the realm of normal. That's mm-hmm. like a big part of it. It's like, mm-hmm. this is what society does. This is what I do. They do not make sense.
Hmm.
These don't go together. Like, it's all very much like
my
that.
Theory could be cockamamie, so don't hold me to it. Like, obviously, you have something that's working very well. So
what's the joke?
Don't let me
make
you.
Now I want to deconstruct one.
That'd be very fun for me. You're also, things like your mom being like, it bleeds.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's like, that's just a good impression. That's character work. That's great.
Okay, character. A lot of character.
I wouldn't call that a category. That's just funny, and I can't give as good of an explanation why. I tend to like jokes that work as a tweet.
It's all character work. I have a joke right now I'm doing about how I found out that the rape wall that, like, when you fuck a woman, you who has been previously raped, oftentimes involuntarily her what's it called? Pelvic floor will shut mm-hmm. and not let the penis in.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard about this a million times. And I asked this forensic nurse and she said it's called vaginismus.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I thought, and I started laughing when I was talking to her because I was thinking that vaginismus sounds like somebody wanted to name it like the Grinch and couldn't. And then I do a whole thing where I'm
well, that's
like,
a joke. Obviously, I mean, you're comparing it to what it sounds like. That's wordplay and that's comparison.
Okay. Comparing yeah. it to what it sounds like. Wordplay and okay.
Right? Cool. Like, yeah. I mean, it's like, yeah. And then just that laugh itself. The whole joke is, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Wow.
Don't overthink this.
I want to. It feels good.
It's just, I like to see things. I mean, I like to break apart things into basic principles and say, what are the rules? What? Because comedy is just so weird and you can't engineer it. There's no algorithm that creates a good joke. And the second there is, those jokes all suck.
Yeah,
it's such an interesting thing.
Yeah.
That there's, and we know that if you need a good joke, there's so few people in the world who can actually do it consistently and well.
Yeah.
That's why joke writers get paid so much, because AI can write contracts. It can solve math problems. It can't write good jokes.
Well, you also just can't.
And when it's good, it's good. And when it's bad. And you know it.
There are things that are like the other day, my friend John came into my apartment and he farted on my dog's face and then said he farted on her, turned and went, pussy, and then went, let's get out of here, Jordan. And I laughed for like 4 days
uh-huh.
at him farting. She's the cutest thing, farts right in her face and goes, pussy, come on, Jordan, let's get out of here. And it was because he was reenacting a scene from like an 80s movie, basically, where the bully's like, bitch, come on, let's blow this popsicle stand. And my dog's face not... knowing what was, it was so much.
There's a video online of someone playing basketball with a dog. That's one of the funniest things ever. The dude's like, duh, 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 you know, yeah. And he crosses over on the dog, and the dog kind of slips. And the whole time, the dog's like, yeah, this is great. And there's just a court side full of black people being like, expose him, yeah. expose him, oh, oh. And what's funny about it is you're doing these things that would be abusive to a human, and yet to a dog, none of the disrespect is laid.
Yeah.
So it's this ferocious animosity that lands so against funny. A pillow.
Yes, yeah, totally.
So it's so funny that you can do this horrible thing and the dog's like, that smells interesting
yeah.
to me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I actually enjoy that. Wait, uh-huh. but what's that called?
I don't know, but I think I would just say the emotional thing is that you get away with this horrible action.
Yeah.
You get to put on, you know, in a padded room. It's just great. It's just so good. Funny.
And it is so nice that it's so funny.
I think it's the disrespect intended with the lack of it that actually lands would be what's funny about that joke.
It's almost like the inertia that you have behind something that goes nowhere. There, yeah. You have so much momentum behind something that means nothing to them.
Uh-huh.
And it's so funny that you... It's like Ian the other day, we were driving and this car cut us off and it was long gone and he smacked the window and flipped them off, but they were so far gone that we were like, you're so... what are you doing?
Uh-huh.
But it was... And it was so silly because that person was... didn't see it, and uh-huh. he just had hurt his hand, being uh-huh. like, you fucking asshole. It's the best. It's like when somebody leaves a room after a fight, and you go, yeah, get out of here, you know?
Yeah, there's a great video online. I'm doing fucking reciting memes, but some guy's just sitting there in the car, and a car, this just douchebag in a sports car pulls up and goes, learn how to drive, you fat piece of fucking bacon, and speeds away, and the guy turns, and he's in the passenger seat.
Oh my God, that's so funny.
It's so funny.
I have
funny.
Seen that. That's so funny.
It's similar but opposite, and it just...
Right, rage at something where it displaced rage is always so funny.
I think it's again, it's just simultaneous proximity and disparity. I think that's always going to be entertaining.
It's so cool how ethereal it all is.
It's great.
It's
I
great.
Love it. I can think about it all day.
Yeah.
It entertains me endlessly. And it's fun because, you know, I studied math and I love math very much, but math, there is an answer and you can find the answer in comedy. There's no path to the answer.
Yeah.
It's just, there's no procedure for writing jokes.
Yeah.
Every
fuck around.
Every joke I have feels like a miracle gift from the universe.
Yes,
that
exactly.
I happened across. That it was like, thank God that word sounds like that word, and this joke all now works. And if it didn't, if I had to change that, the joke would completely fail.
Right, I know. And you'll have those things where it'll make you laugh, and you're like, it doesn't make any sense. You write it down, you try it, and you're like, wow, it's also making them laugh. They don't know why it makes sense. It's really cool. It's awesome. Okay, that's great. That's it. We've got
a word from our sponsors.
Oh, yeah. Now I have to read fucking ads. Well, thank you for coming in.
Thanks so much for having
me.
That
was awesome.
Thank you.
I hope people like the Inside Baseball. We'll call it Inside Baseball.
Yeah,
Harry,
sorry
the episode's
for indulging.
Called Inside Baseball. Okay, cool.